This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, Crossover, NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What's happening, Beck?
Nothing here, but apparently lots of exciting things down in the city of brotherly love. So we'll have to go check that out.
Yeah, we're going to get into the evolving Ben Simmons situation. We're going to talk about the Lakers, who are dealing with yet another injury to a player in their rotation. Also, Kyrie Irving, some developments there. Over the last couple of days or so. You have an episode coming on Friday, Beck? What do we got going on for the Friday pod?
Definitely have something coming Friday. Apologies to those who missed this past Friday. Had to duck out.
How dare you? Yes,
I know.
How dare you?
I know. Something coming Friday. Guest to be determined. We will see.
All right, make sure you check out Beck's pod on Friday. Same feed, same everything. Don't even have to resubscribe to another podcast. All right, Howard, I love it when there's breaking news when we start reporting this podcast or recording this podcast. The news on Monday per ESPN and The Athletic is that Ben Simmons and the Philadelphia 76ers are working towards a scenario where Ben Simmons returns. This is not, to me, the least bit surprising. The Sixers have made it abundantly clear that they aren't dealing Ben Simmons anytime soon. They have spoken to teams about Ben Simmons. I'm told none of the offers for Simmons have been even close to what they were looking for. And I think we kind of knew, Howard, at some point, Simmons was going to get a little unsettled over the amount of money he was losing, north of $350,000 every single game. So he's already going to lose or has lost over $1 million at this point. And despite the fact that Simmons has made $57 million in his career in on-court earnings, probably a lot more or close to it, in off-court earnings, losing that kind of money just wasn't going to happen. So give me your reaction to the news that the Sixers and Simmons, at least for now, are working towards a Simmons return.
This looks to me like two things. One, Ben Simmons blinked. It's like $1 million blink. And $1 million and counting, right? Like every preseason and then regular season game he's missing, it just keeps piling up. Nobody, I don't care how much money you have earned or how much you're due to earn or think you may earn, nobody wants to just wave goodbye to that kind of money. And it's not in his hands, the timing of this resolution. The Sixers make the deal when they have a deal worth making. That's it. It's pretty simple. So this whole idea that he was going to sit out and it's going to somehow force their hand, force Daryl Morey and Sixers ownership to trade a perennial all-star for less than what they think they should get was bonkers from the beginning. This was a terrible gambit by the Clutch Agency and Ben Simmons and the rest of his camp. Whoever made the final call on deciding that this was the way they were going to approach this, they made a grave error. And if Ben Simmons is back in Philly sometime soon on the court with his teammates, that will be an admission of this error.
Well, I mean, that's the big thing here. If we take this a step further and say Ben Simmons does come back to the 76ers, in what capacity is he going to be coming back? Like, is he going to report and then immediate, like, fake an injury, or the Sixers, you know, kind of keep him on the sidelines for now? Because I don't know if they've reached the point of no return with the players in that locker room, but it's getting close to it. I mean, Simmons and people around him have been leaking like a sieve over the last, you know, month or so. You know, whether it's teammates were interested in flying out to see Ben Simmons and Ben Simmons killed it. Ben Simmons is mentally exhausted. Ben Simmons feels his relationship with Joel Embiid has run its course. Like, there have been a lot of things coming out of Simmons camp that have not been flattering towards the 76ers or the players in that locker room. I mean, do you see a scenario where Embiid, Tobias Harris, anyone else, any other veterans in that locker room just warmly embrace a Ben Simmons return? I understand that, you know, winning cures all, and if Simmons is the player we've seen for most of the last few years, he'll be an asset to that team, but this feels like a thorny situation Simmons might be stepping into in that locker room.
Has to be. It has to be. I mean, he made a trade demand. Now, you could say that's about the organization, or you can say it's about his own career goals, but listen, everybody, you know, these are people we're dealing with. If you're one of his teammates, that feels like a rejection. That's, you don't want to be part of us anymore? To the extent that you were willing to sacrifice potentially millions to stay away, and now you're coming back? I mean, I think they'll all put their best face on it. Could he play and could they function at a high level? Sure. I mean, it goes back to that whole, you don't have to be friends to be a great team, yada, yada. Like, we've seen it. Okay, fine. But this is pretty extreme. Everybody knows he wants to be gone. Everybody knows that he is doing everything possible to make that happen, and that the only reason he's back is to protect his bank account. How can that not poison the chemistry or at least create severe awkwardness in that locker room? To say nothing of what happens, Chris, on October 22nd, their home opener against the Brooklyn Nets. Like, the fans are going to tear Ben Simmons apart. And I don't think it's even going to be limited to Philly. It'll be worse in Philly for sure. But Ben Simmons is going to get taunted everywhere he goes until this is resolved, and probably even after that for a while, but it'll be less so after that. But in the meantime, like, every hostile crowd is going to be shouting everything possible to just drive that stake in a little further. Like, yeah, you don't even want to play with these guys. And, you know, we're all going to be watching for body language and anything that looks passive aggressive on the court, sideways glances. Like, it's not going to be pleasant, but it's the right thing. Let's be clear. As big of a mistake as it was for Ben Simmons to be gone, this, like, there's no good outcome now except to finally get traded whenever the Sixers get the right deal. But, like, this is the right thing. Going back and making good on your contract and your obligation to the franchise and your teammates is the right thing, no matter how awkward it gets.
Yeah, it's the right thing. It's the only thing. It was an unprecedented situation called that for a reason. I mean, the guy has 4 years left on his contract. It's one thing to be Anthony Davis and say midway through the penultimate year of your contract that you want out of New Orleans. It's another thing to be Ben Simmons and say with 4 years left and $147 million on that deal that you want out of Philadelphia. I mean, I just, you mentioned the strategy. I just don't, looking back now, I don't understand. If Ben Simmons reports, I don't understand what the strategy was, unless they really believed that the Sixers were going to be bullied into making a deal that they didn't like just to get away from the toxicity of the situation. It's going to wind up costing Ben Simmons seven figures, and that's money he's never, ever going to get back. And again, you can say, well, he's going to earn $140 more million. Okay, great, but he's still going to be $1 million shy, and that's real money that you're not going to get back. And I'm with you. That first home game, that's going to be rough. He's going to get introduced. If he comes back, he's going to get introduced into the starting lineup, and he's going to get booed loudly because everybody knows that Simmons' time in Philadelphia is going to be short-lived. I mean, Simmons is reporting personally to keep collecting checks, but the Sixers want him to report, so he plays well, and they can trade him. And they hope the Wizards tank or the Blazers tank so they can send him to one of those two teams and bring back a star return. It is going to be a very, very awkward 2 or 3 months if Ben Simmons comes back.
Well, and lest anybody be deceived or deluded into thinking that, well, maybe they patch this all up and he stays after all, we have a report within, you know, also on Monday from Keith Pompey out of Philly saying Ben Simmons's house is on the market. So let's not think there's any other outcome possible here. He's
going to wind up living in like the Ritz-Carlton residences down the street until, I mean, it's just wild. This is just so wild.
I don't even know what the answer to this question is, Chris, but I cannot think of, maybe you can, when a guy was going to be booed or treated as badly as he will be in their home market. Like LeBron going back to Cleveland the first time when he was with the Miami Heat after he left in 2010 is the most vicious.
Yeah, but he was a visitor.
But he was a visitor. That was the most hostile. And by like hostile doesn't do it justice. It was vicious and it was dehumanizing what I saw that night in Cleveland. this may be the first time we get that kind of treatment from somebody who's actually in the home uniform. I don't even know what the analogy or the analog is for this. I don't recall any situation like this where I expect somebody to be just torn apart by their home fans to this extent.
And we know Simmons is a little sensitive. I mean, the reason he's staying away is, I'm being generous there, but the reason he's staying away is because Doc Rivers and Joel Embiid said mean things to him or blamed him for what happened at the end of the playoffs last year. That's at least part of it. So, you know, maybe getting iced out by some teammates in that locker room, getting booed. I mean, it's going to be, again, I hate to use the word interesting, but it is just going to be an interesting few months in Philadelphia. If Simmons winds up reporting, we should say at the time of recording this podcast, it's just being discussed at this point. No timetable for Simmons to come back to Philadelphia. All right, I want to talk about a still-developing situation with Kyrie Irving in Brooklyn. Kyrie already missed the Nets' second preseason game in Brooklyn, but good news for the Nets, the city of New York has deemed the Nets' practice facility a private building. Therefore, Kyrie can practice outside of these vaccine requirements. So that is good news. The bad news is that the Nets are now publicly accepting that for now, Kyrie Irving is not going to be available for home game. This is what Steve Nash said earlier this week about Kyrie's availability. So it's kind of a good news, bad news situation with Kyrie Irving, Howard. What did you take away from the developments of the last 24, 48 hours?
I mean, it always felt like this is where we were going to be. The ambiguity was that Kyrie Irving on Media Day, when he did his you know, video interview because he couldn't be on the premises, Kyrie made it sound as if we're going to work this out, or like, you know, stay tuned kind of thing. Give me my privacy and it'll all be all, you know, it's going to be fine. Which made me think like either there was some kind of accommodation being worked out, or maybe he was going to get the vaccine after all and he just didn't want to say it. So there was at least this like tiny percentage of ambiguity until Steve Nash the other day says, quote, we're going to have to for sure play without him this year, and it's just a matter of when and how much. Like that, you know, and I mean, it felt inevitable, but I think the Nets and Steve Nash giving it voice makes this feel very real. They are absolutely preparing for the likelihood now that they're going to be without Kyrie Irving for all their home games, plus the two games at Madison Square Garden. And that is putting a severe crimp, I think, in the Nets' hopes this season. I mean, you know, you build a team with three superstars so that you can be overwhelming, so that you could just blow out everybody, so that you have all the margin for error you could possibly have, and so you can just overwhelm another defense. You take Kyrie Irving out of that for half the games, your margin for error goes down. You still have maybe the best 1-2 punch in the league. Offensively, that's fine. You got a pretty deep group. That's fine. But you don't just go through a season with a guy voluntarily, and I will say it is voluntarily, he is choosing to do this, to miss half the season and not have it have some effect on your chemistry, on interpersonal relationships, on everything. To say nothing of, as we've alluded to before, if this is still the case, if the law is still in place and he's still unvaccinated in the spring, Kyrie Irving missing half of every playoff series, including, assuming they have home court advantage, a potential like decisive game 7 at home. There's no precedent for this, and it's insane. And, the closer we get to opening night and the longer this is unresolved, the more you have to believe that this is their reality. And the only thing that changes that, aside from a change in the law, would be trading Kyrie Irving.
Yeah, so I've kind of had my opinion evolve on this, Howard. I think the city of New York should make Kyrie Irving eligible to play at Barclays. I think he should be granted an exemption to play. The reason is Kyrie is not out there as a typical New Yorker. He's not walking around unvaccinated, unmonitored, untested. Because Kyrie Irving is unvaccinated, he has to follow the stringent, most stringent of protocols that the NBA has put him through. He has to undergo daily testing every time he enters a team facility. He has to have lab-based testing on game day. That's part of his testing. Outside of the testing procedures, in the locker room, he has to sit as far away from vaccinated players as possible. He must stay masked and be 6 feet away from all other attendees in a team meeting. In addition, as an unvaccinated player, he is, quote, required to remain at his residence when in his home market. When he has to stay in a team hotel property, this is on the road, there are permissible exceptions, buying groceries, taking kids to school, that kind of stuff. They're also forbidden from visiting high-risk setting, which are called restaurants, bars, clubs, entertainment venues, large indoor gatherings. Kyrie Irving, even though he's unvaccinated, is probably one of the safer people to be indoors because of that testing. So for that reason, I think New York not giving him an exemption is a little performative. I mean, if every citizen in the city of New York had to go through the protocols that Kyrie Irving has to go through, we'd probably be out of this pandemic in New York. I mean, if we could afford the kind of testing that Kyrie is having to do and the protocols he's having to follow, it wouldn't be an issue in the city of New York. So this is not an argument for vaccination or non-vaccination. I'm not making that case at all. I'm simply pointing out the facts that because Kyrie's in the NBA, he has to go through rigorous testing, daily testing, that make him not an unsafe person in that locker room.
I think it's a fair point. I mean, I think if I were Kyrie's representation, if I were the Nets, unless the Nets, of course, don't want to make this argument because they just want him to get vaccinated and not have to deal with any of this in the first place. I mean, I think it's a persuasive argument to make that this law is, of course, broadly drawn, as all laws are, right? It's to encompass all of these different venues across the city. It's not targeted at the Nets. It's not targeted at the Knicks. It's not targeted at specific concert performers or anybody else. This is about all of these spaces that fit this description in the law, right? It's broadly based. It's broadly drawn. It is not designed to account for the fact that in this case, Kyrie Irving has to abide by the strictest of protocols as an NBA player. So that's why I would push back on the idea this is performative, Chris. It's not performative. It's just broadly drawn. It's a law.
The law itself is not performative. I actually agree with the law. I think we're better off if big indoor venues where thousands of people are going to be crammed in are only attended by vaccinated players. I mean, if somebody else out there can prove that they're going through the type of testing and protocols that Kyrie is proving, he should be allowed in, but you can't. It's too expensive. It's too much for one person to be able to pull off.
Right. But the city is doing this as a broad matter to try to do everything possible, right, of course, to stem the pandemic and to keep numbers down, to spread,
But shouldn't there be exceptions for every rule? I mean,
I don't know what that process would be, but if there is a possibility of saying, look, this is a special case, this is different, not because Kyrie, or because he's rich, or because it's the NBA, or anything else, but just because he has to abide by all the protocols that you just laid out in detail, Chris, like, I think that that is a persuasive argument. Yes, I would say that City Hall should consider that, and maybe consider an exception. Does that open some kind of Pandora's box for them? Does that create?
I don't think so. See, here's why I don't think so.
But you and I don't know who else in this city is going to say, "Oh, I was going to be covered by this, but I shouldn't be because of X, Y, Z." I don't know how many other cases that would make room for that. I mean, that would be the only thing off the top of my head.
I don't know how many it would make room for. Like, I think what gives City Hall cover is you can say, "All right, if you can prove you're going through the same type of testing and stuff that Kyrie is doing, you can get an exception too. You can get an exception there too."
Sure, and I would just say this. Especially considering what Kyrie Irving did last time he was off the grid for a little while and showed up at a birthday party and some other stuff.
Oh, no. Hold on.
You said proof of abiding by the kind of protocols he is. How much proof do we even have that Kyrie Irving is going to be abiding by these protocols?
Don't disagree at all. In fact, if Kyrie breaks these protocols, the exemption should be removed. That's it. Like, he gets one shot, one crack at this apple. Like, but I think you give him at least an opportunity to follow all these rules. You're right. Go back to last January. Went to a birthday party unmasked while he was away from the team. That was wrong. You had to pay the price for that from the NBA. I think the city tells Kyrie Irving, we're going to grant you this exemption. You follow all the NBA rules. If we see a picture of you getting a cheesecake at Junior's, you are going to be That exemption is going to be removed. We don't want to see you at a nightclub. We don't want to see you at a New York City bar or restaurant. You need to follow these rules. If you do, exemption stands. If you don't, gone. No right. Second chances, nothing, just that.
Let's be clear, though, on this, too, though. Yes, City Hall could, I think, in theory, grant an exemption. Yes, I agree with you. There is a compelling case to make that maybe he should be granted an exemption. On the other hand, he's chosen to take this hardline stance against a vaccine that is safe and effective, that everybody, every decent, credible public health official, doctor, epidemiologist, everybody on earth who has any expertise in this says it's safe and effective. There is no case whatsoever that it is not safe or effective. And so there's no reason whatsoever to be a holdout still. 95% plus now of the NBA has gotten the vaccine among the players, all staff, all coaches, all referees. 187 million Americans are fully vaccinated and 2.8 billion worldwide. People are not dropping like flies. They're not growing third eyes. They're fine. And there's a part of me that thinks, yeah, you could draw these, you could create this exemption for sure. Is that the right message for City Hall to send? Is that even the right message for the Nets to send by making that appeal if it were them making the appeal? Or should this just be, you know what, Kyrie, knock it off already. You're a rebel without a cause. This isn't saying let's not go to the bubble because we're at a time of social unrest and we need to take a stand in terms of social justice issues. Like that, like I sympathize with that. You want to like say like I can't play right now or we shouldn't play because of some broader cause, fine. This is not a cause. This is idiocy.
Yeah, look, on a personal level, I think everybody should get vaccinated. I agree with everything you said on a personal level. But I think if you look at this situation objectively, Kyrie is being tested every single day, sometimes maybe even twice during a day. I don't see him as a danger to the public. And because of that, I think New York should grant that exemption. All right, let's move out west and talk a little bit about your Los Angeles Lakers. The Lakers, not a great start to the preseason. You have had two big injuries. Trevor Ariza, who is going to be out for 8 weeks after having surgery, I believe, on his ankle surgery. And you have Talen Horton-Tucker with surgery on his hand that's going to keep him out an indefinite period of time. These were two key rotation players for the Lakers that we're going to rely on. Ariza might have been a starter. Talen Horton-Tucker, I had talked to Rob Pelinka, Frank Vogel. They had huge expectations for Talen Horton-Tucker this year, particularly defensively. They wanted to see Horton-Tucker be the guy that embraces the top wing challenge when he's out there on the floor. Now they have to turn to guys like Kent Bazemore, Malik Monk, some of the other guys, Carmelo Anthony, I'm sure is going to get more playing time as a result of this. And on the court, you've got Russell Westbrook basically drop kicking the ball away for the first two preseason games. 6 turnovers in the first one, 9 turnovers in the second. Westbrook laughed off his 9 turnovers in his second preseason game. Frank Vogel, of course, give the whole remain calm, all is well speech. I'll ask you, what is your level of concern right now for the Los Angeles Lakers?
What's like a notch above zero?
Okay.
0.1 or something? Yeah, the Lakers have looked, you know, shaky as hell in the preseason, especially for a team with championship hopes and all that. But, you know, before we commence overreaction theater, let's note that the big three have not played together. They will Tuesday night, but they haven't yet. LeBron's played a total of 18 minutes in 4 games, and of those 18 were actually all in one game, so there's 3 games he didn't even play. Anthony Davis has played 64 minutes over 3 games. Westbrook's played 43 minutes over 2 games. And the one time LeBron played, Anthony Davis did not. There are 4 top guys in minutes so far are Kendrick Nunn, the aforementioned Kent Bazemore, Wayne Ellington, and DeAndre Jordan. So I'm not concerned about the results per se. The injuries to Talen Horton-Tucker as one of their only young guys in the rotation, not great. Monk has something going on, and he's banged up. Ariza's out a couple months.
Monk still, like, I keep hearing a lot of optimism about Malik Monk. It still raises a massive red flag when the Charlotte Hornets don't give you a qualifying offer. I mean, that to me
yes.
is...
But...
That makes me a little skeptical of what Malik Monk is going to be able to deliver.
Agreed. There is a long history in this league of guys who were not so great as role players on teams where they had to do too much, going and finding the right stars to play off of and finding another level. Like Malik Monk playing off of LeBron and Westbrook and Anthony Davis. I mean, I understand the optimism. Like there's something there. Anyway, it's I don't know if these are warning signs, Chris, or if this is just like what you should expect now. Like another short offseason, they're not playing their stars. No one really cares about the preseason. We'll know a lot more about how their big three fit together, about especially how Westbrook and LeBron mesh once the regular season actually starts. The injuries aside, I'm not concerned about what's gone on in the preseason. They're just trying to get a feel for all these guys. And look, part of this too is, it's a brand new freaking roster. They turned over the entire thing around LeBron and AD.
Yeah. 10 new players there. I am a little concerned about the Westbrook stuff. Now, Westbrook is definitely trying to adapt his game, which I've said on this podcast before. Westbrook does try to do that. It sometimes gets lost in his like ultra aggressive drives and bad shot selection. But when he's changed locations, he has tried to fit in with his new teammates. He tried to evolve his game a little bit with James Harden. He tried to evolve his game with Bradley Beal. He doesn't change it entirely. He doesn't overhaul it, but he's tried to tweak it a little bit, which differs, in my opinion, from like, and you covered this, like Carmelo Anthony never really tried at his prime to change his game. He was going to be Carmelo no matter what, especially during those years in New York. And it cost him, ultimately, because he wasn't able to find a home for a couple of years. I think Westbrook is trying. He's trying to be the extra pass guy. He's trying to be the facilitator and not take bad shots. But ultimately, he's going to commit turnovers because he commits turnovers. He's not going to be a three-point shooter because he's not a three-point shooter. That's kind of what I've seen from what I've seen of these preseason games. Westbrook just looked a little bit unsettled in his situation and not sure how he fits playing off of LeBron James. If he's not going to be able to knock down three-point shots off LeBron's drives to the paint, it's hard for me to see how you maximize a player of the talent of Russell Westbrook.
No, I mean, look, one way of going about this, and we've talked about this before, is maybe you're staggering them as much as possible. You're starting games with Westbrook and LeBron.
That's what they're going to do. Like, that is 100% what they're going to do. Like, the question is, like, how quickly does Frank Vogel pull Russell Westbrook off the floor in the first few minutes? I mean, does he go, like, 2 minutes and just yank Russ? And again, you and I have discussed this. Like, it's less important at the beginning. It's the end. Like, if Russell's not on the floor for the final 6 minutes, that might be the Lakers' best lineup, but how is that going to sit with Westbrook? Right now, he's saying all the right things, help a team win a championship. That's what Frank Vogel told me a couple of weeks ago, said every conversation he's had with Russell Westbrook has been about Westbrook's desire to win a championship. That's easy to do, or easy to have that attitude when you're out there on the floor, but if he's not in the fourth quarter, and the Lakers are going with some combination of Kendrick Nunn and Malik Monk and Bazemore because they're better perimeter shooters, I wonder how that's going to sit with Westbrook.
It will be an issue if that happens, if it happens that way. It will be an issue if he plays and can't do enough to enhance LeBron in tight fourth quarters because he can't, you know, he's not a threat to hit three-pointers off of LeBron's drives because he's not somebody who's willing as an off-the-ball player to move. He's not been a slasher. He's not a screen setter. You know, the stats are all out there on all these things. Maybe those, because those are the things he has to adjust, Chris. Like, will he give up a little bit of control? Sure. Will he maybe take a few less shots in a game? Sure. But it's really the other stuff. It's not what you're giving up. It's what are you willing to actually do? Are you willing to be useful off the ball? Because you're going to have to be off the ball. And that's the question.
What is his use? I ask is, what is his use off the ball? Like, I'm not trying to be disrespectful to Russell Westbrook, but like, okay, like you mean like playing the dunk position like Ben Simmons did, you know, for many
just
of his years?
Just don't stand. How about just not standing around to start with?
I guess.
Mean, he doesn't move off the ball. Look, like this is where it's going to come down to is, you know, when they're out there together, what's his best role? How do you use him? Because the ball can't be in his hands because then it's not in LeBron's hands and it should always be in LeBron's hands. So that's the challenge for Frank Vogel. The issue right now is we don't even have a hint as to how they're going to answer that because they've barely played together. So maybe we'll find out a little bit more Tuesday night when the big three play together for the first time. At least that's what we've read is the plan. And we'll find out in earnest once the regular season starts. But the Lakers have a lot of unanswered questions for a team that is expected to go to the finals.
Yeah, I'm dying to see, you know, opening night for the Lakers, what that rotation looks like, because it is the biggest challenge of Frank Vogel's career to kind of find a rotation that works, that is successful on the floor and keeps everybody happy, especially their big three, off the floor as well. All right, I want to finish with another one of your teams, the New York Knicks. I was in Vegas this past weekend, Howard, at the Fury Wilder fight. Well, I mean, I love the Vegas. I was there for the Fury Wilder fight, and I popped into a couple of sports books while I was there, and I noticed at one of them that the Knicks over-under number of wins was 41.5. And I'm not a big gambler when it comes to sports betting, but I was really tempted to put every nickel I have on the over on that one. How is a Knicks team that I think went, 41-31 last year, won 41 games in a 72-game season last year, how are they only listed as the over-under only listed at 41.5? Do you understand that? I think the Knicks got better, a lot better. Like, I think the addition of Kemba Walker and Evan Fournier will help an offense that was a liability at times last season. The return of Mitchell Robinson will only enhance a defense that moved into the top five last season. The continued development of the young players on the roster, specifically RJ Barrett, is going to be a boost for the Knicks this season. And I understand Julius Randle has only done what he did last year once, but I don't really believe that Randle's going to have some big drop-off in year two in the same system with the same coach. I think the Knicks, 46-47 wins next year. I mean, if that number is still out there when you check your sports betting app or go to your Nevada sports book, bet over. It's, to me, unless things completely fall apart, that Knicks team is a 45-46 win team at least.
So to your point, the math says that they were a 47-win team last year. So the equivalent of their 41-win season in a 72-game season is about 46-47 wins. So that's what we're talking about. So we're talking about a drop-off if Vegas, if the over-under were accurate, a drop-off of 5 or 6 wins, which does sound a little ridiculous given that they are on paper better than they were when they ended the season a few months ago. Two things. One, you know, like Vegas is not some accurate, you know, indicator of anything other than where people's money is going and what they can do to best separate you from your money.
You know where most of the money is going, though, in Vegas? To Vegas and out of people's pockets. So exactly. They do know a little bit about this.
No, they know how to separate you from your money. They don't know how to predict what the NBA, what an NBA team is going to actually do.
Like, who in New York are they separating from their money if New York fans bet the over on that?
Oh, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying that. I'm saying the entire purpose of a betting line is not to accurately predict anything. The purpose of a betting line is to separate you from your money no matter which way you bet. Anyway, it's not about it being accurate. So all that said, there is this kind of enigma about the Knicks. And everybody around the league, I think, feels this on some level. They are better on paper, but are going to be worse in the standings. Now, it's only a matter of how much worse. And the reason is not because the Knicks didn't improve. They did. Kemba is an upgrade. Evan Fournier is an upgrade. Quickly and Barrett presumably taking the next step forward on some level. Small steps, big steps, whatever it may be. Every indication should be that they should improve.
Derrick Rose only plays well with Tom Thibodeau. So, or at least more often plays well with Tom
Thibodeau. And they'll have a full season of him instead of a half season. Yes. So, yes. But here's the thing. There are five teams that I think almost everyone expects are going to be better than them. That's Brooklyn, Milwaukee, Atlanta, Philly, and Miami. Now, Philly's got this big-ass asterisk on it because of the Ben Simmons situation, but as of now, they have Ben Simmons. They're still pretty great without him, I would say, and they're going to eventually get something for him, and it should be pretty valuable. So Brooklyn, Milwaukee, Atlanta, Philly, Miami, those are the five that most people around the league think will be better than the Knicks. And depending on where you are on the Celtics, like people, like there's wild divergence in people's opinions on the Celtics, but Boston could be there too. That would knock the Knicks down to the play-in range to seventh, where they'd be battling with Chicago, Toronto, Indiana, Washington, and Charlotte, potentially. I'm going broad here. Like you can toss out any of those you don't believe in. But if that's the case, you're now in this like 5 or 6 way battle for the 7 to 10 slots, and you're in the play-in instead. So the number on the win total, I don't understand by Vegas. I don't ever understand Vegas. I don't bet, so I don't understand this stuff anyway. But I do understand the idea that the Knicks could be improved on the roster, but worse in the standings, because that's almost certainly going to be the case. That's not a knock. That is just about the fact that the Nets will have a full-ish season of their big three. The Bucks are defending champs. The Hawks beat them in the playoffs. The Heat got better and won't have Jimmy Butler's COVID to deal with this time. Like, some of these other teams underachieved. We don't know what Washington will be. We don't know what Chicago will be. Charlotte's a team on the rise. Like, it's crowded. The East is, like, the East isn't necessarily fantastic at the top. The top two are obviously title contenders. But there's great depth of really, really good teams, of really strong teams that we have not seen in a long time. And because of that, it necessarily is going to you know, pull all those teams that are in that fat middle down a little bit when it comes to win totals.
Yeah, I don't deny that the Eastern Conference is a lot deeper than it was last year. There are fewer gimmies in that conference this year for all the reasons you said. Indiana will be better. Rick Carlisle is going to make them better, I think, right off the bat. I think the Wizards are more balanced this year with the trade that they made. I think that's going to make them ultimately better. Under Tom Thibodeau, you just have an advantage when it comes to winning regular season games because your team is always going to play hard. They're always going to defend. And if they can just manufacture enough offense, they're going to win a lot of these close games. I wouldn't bet on the Knicks to win a single playoff series. Like, if that was the bet I could make right now, I would bet on the Knicks getting beat in the first round because in the playoffs, you need bigger stars. And what I saw from Julius Randle in the postseason tells me he is not built to be the number one guy. Now, maybe Kemba helps with that if he's healthy throughout the season. Fournier, if Thibodeau can stomach him being on the floor defensively, maybe he helps in that situation. But I think in the playoffs, where everybody plays hard, and that's what they ran into against Atlanta. The Hawks played just as hard as the Knicks in the playoffs, and their talent was better. So I don't buy them in the postseason, but I do buy them to be a very successful 4-5 seed again in the Eastern Conference in the regular season. That means 45-46 wins.
Yeah, and it's not impossible. I mean, it could happen, but it's going to mean beating some of those teams that I mentioned earlier that, as of now, look like they should be better teams than the Knicks. Remember, a lot broke the Knicks' way last year. Doesn't mean they didn't earn it. Doesn't mean it wasn't a great season. But a lot broke their way in terms of other teams being affected by COVID, by injuries, by other things. There's also, I mean, some legitimate questions here, right? Like, Reggie Bullock was possibly their best wing defender.
Yep.
Probably their best. He's gone. Kemba is a massive defensive liability and was even before all the knee issues that he's had. You know, there's a reason the Celtics essentially gave him away and that the Thunder then just bought him out.
Oh, I got a glimpse. I got a glimpse of the Kemba Fournier backcourt in Boston. You are not stopping many people on the perimeter with those two guys.
So are we still going to see that, whatever they were last year, top five defense by the Knicks when you've got that kind of backcourt? That's putting a lot of pressure on Nerlens Noel, Taj Gibson, Mitchell Robinson. Mitchell Robinson, who cannot stay healthy. Nerlens Noel, who has a pretty massive injury history of his own. Like, there's plenty of questions here where, you know, I mean, a lot of teams are like this, right? You take like five different things and you say, well, if they all point up, they're overachieving. They all point down, they're underachieving. And, you know, if they get a split, they're okay. But there's a lot of, you know, serious questions here where if it goes the wrong way with Kemba, if it goes the wrong way with their defense, if it goes the wrong way with the health of their bigs, it could take a bad turn. And now you're really relying a lot on, you know, Quickly and Barrett to make the leap, on Derrick Rose to continue this late career renaissance. You know, Rose is 33, by the way. So, like, yep. I don't know how much you can squeeze out of him. Taj is 36. So there's some caveats in there.
Well, once again, Mannix, bullish on the Knicks. Beck, lukewarm at best.
I'm just saying. There's some things.
Howard, good luck on the Friday podcast. Check out Howard Beck every Friday with his podcast on the Crossover feed. And we'll see what happens next week, Howard. I'm sure there'll be a lot to talk about when we reconvene next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.